The next case on the docket is appeal number 22-1016, Click-to-Call Technologies versus Ingenio. Mr. Shi, Mr. Shi, you may proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, my name is Dan Shi on behalf of Click-to-Call Technologies. The district court's judgment was riddled with multiple independent errors, each of which requires overturning the judgment. I'd like to focus on the IPR estoppel issue, because especially after the Caltech decision, that issue has become particularly and even more clear-cut. Section 315 imposes IPR estoppel on any grounds that were raised or could have been raised in an IPR. And we know from the SAS decision and from Caltech that the scope of an IPR is defined by the petition, not by any institution decision. The DiZono reference could have been raised, undisputably, reasonably could have been raised in the IPR petition. It wasn't. Instead, Ingenio relied only on grounds based on the Freeman reference for Claim 27. So we clearly fall within the scope of what IPR estoppel covers, and the Caltech decision confirms that the scope of IPR estoppel extends.
Excuse me, let me ask you, what do you make or what do you say about footnote 5 in the Caltech decision where I guess Judge Lynn wrote, SAS was decided while IPR proceedings remain pending before the board. Accordingly, we need not decide the scope of preclusion in cases in which the board declined to institute on all grounds and issued its final decision pre-SAS. We're in that ballpark, aren't we?
We're in what the footnote is sort of referring to. And yeah. What Caltech did was it interpreted the statute correctly. And so we are definitely within the scope of how Caltech interpreted this statute. So now the question is, should this court make some sort of judicially created exception to that scope of of IPR estoppel for cases that involved a partial institution?
Or put another way, is this a case where Shaw still applies? Because footnote 5 in Caltech said, hey, we're not addressing this issue that may have existed in Shaw. And so your question might be whether Shaw can be distinguished.
Well, Shaw absolutely can be distinguished. Shaw was addressing a issue that was raised in the IPR, a petition, and then wasn't addressed in the final written decision. Here, we're in a world where it's reasonably could have raised realm, and there is no reason.
As I understand it, is that because the IPR was instituted on DiZono, that they were in the realm of could have raised, because in fact the PTO did consider DiZono, and it was the petitioner's choice not to raise Claim 27.
The petitioner raised Claim 27, but asserted only Freeman DiZono grounds, just not the DiZono grounds. And the partial institution here is kind of neither here nor there with regard to why IPR estoppel should apply. If you play it out, if the complaint is they were somehow prejudiced because Claim 27, the Freeman grounds on Claim 27 weren't addressed, well, let's play that out. You know, if the final written decision had addressed the Freeman grounds, Ingenio might have won or lost on them. We think lost. But in any event, the DiZono-based grounds for Claim 27 would have been estopped. So whether it was a partial institution or a full institution doesn't matter.
Can I ask you, with the situation, the case would be analogous to Shaw, I think, if the PTO had instituted on the Freeman grounds but not the DiZono grounds, right?
No.
Let me ask you a different question. Forget about that question. I guess my question is, you would agree that they're not a stop from raising the Freeman grounds?
I would not agree with that, but that would certainly be a different argument, because we'd be in a place where they might argue that they haven't had their day on the Freeman-based ground. However, I will note that as the statute is properly interpreted, with the understanding that the IPR scope is defined by the petition, the Freeman-based ground is estopped. Now, should there be some judicially created exception to that? I think not, because the IPR partial institution arose from a misreading of the statute by the PTAB, thinking that it had the authority to do that. one doesn't remedy a misreading of the statute by further misreading the statute. Instead, the remedy is to go back to the PTAB and seek vacator of the partial institution decision, thereby undoing the final written decision. And in fact, this court, in Your Honor, Judge Stoll's opinion in Atlanta Gaslight versus Bennett Regulator just about a week ago, this court reaffirmed that the Patent Board has the authority to reconsider its institution decisions and to vacate them if it so decides. And the interesting thing about that case was, in that case, the final written decision had already issued, and this court had affirmed the final written decision. And yet, the PTAB was found to have the authority to, on remand, to reconsider its institution decision and then vacate it. So that's the remedy that Ingenio could have taken post-SAS or even post the exhaustion of the appeals in this case. In the case of the IPR appeals, could have sought to vacate the IPR partial institution decision and avoid IPR estoppel effects rather than complaining to this court about the scope of IPR estoppel under the statute. So IPR estoppel absolutely should apply, but that's in the Freeman base ground, but it absolutely should apply to the DiZono base ground, which was omitted from the petition. On that ground, the judgment below needs to be, with respect to Claim 27, needs to be overturned.
And if that happens, there'll be a determination as to infringement with respect to Claim 27.
At trial? Yeah, yes. We would proceed to trial. Yeah, I mean, this court should vacate the decision below and remand for trial on the claim, which is infringement, of course. So if the court decides based on the IPR estoppel ground, it doesn't actually need to reach the other grounds of error for Claim 27. I may touch on those, but I'd like to turn now, unless there are questions about IPR estoppel, to what happened with Claims 24 and 28. Claims 24 and 28, the district court's summary judgment order decided to disallow Click-to-Call from continue to assert those claims. Those were the claims that survived, 27, 24, and 28 were the claims that survived the IPR. The district court's disallowance of 24 and 28 was over the express agreement of the parties to litigate those three claims. And that's an agreement that was endorsed by the district court.
This was like 8 years later, right? 8 years later, and you think that there was an express agreement by both the parties to have those claims litigated because you identified them and nobody noticed until later that, no, actually claims 24 and 28 weren't identified as asserted claims when you were asked to assert them 8 years or to identify them 8 years earlier, right?
Judge Stoll, your question is assuming that there's a possibility that Ingenio simply overlooked that those claims were being asserted despite.
What you're saying, but I don't see an affirmative statement by them saying, "Oh, we agree that these will be the claims, and that it's okay for them to amend the claims that are considered by the court." I don't think it's fair to assert that they didn't appreciate. That they agreed. You're asserting that they acquiesced, and I just don't see that.
Well, I think we have to take Ingenio at their word in their district court brief at Appendix 3658 in their footnote 1. They say there that they raise no issue in the status report with proceeding with claims 24, 10, 27, and 28, quote, to preserve its, Ingenio's, declaratory judgment counterclaims. So they admitted that they agreed to litigate all three of those claims because they wanted judgment on their non-infringement and validity counterclaims with respect to those.
Mr. G, isn't the district court, or in this case, I guess it was the magistrate acting for the district court, isn't that person entitled to go back and look at the record and make an independent decision as to what claims are going to be heard based upon the earlier determination and decision that was made to which Judge Stoll referred? I mean, the court isn't bound, is it, by the colloquy between the parties?
The parties presented to the court a status report proposing to litigate the three claims and to lift the stay and to proceed with that and to proceed to some, you know, they wanted to file a summary judgment motion before, other litigation occurred, but to litigate all three of those claims. That was in the status report. At the status conference, it was just confirmatory discussion about proceeding with all three of those claims.
So if your view is that the district court judge was not able to rely on the statements, the notice of claim selected at A1258?
That notice had been filed before the IPR. After the IPRs were over, before the stay was lifted, the parties had a status conference, of course, because a lot of time had passed.
In between? And there's this huge time frame that I think that Judge Stoll was identifying and at least I'm struggling with. Did anything happen in terms of updates to the court where there was going to be kind of this switch in claims, or was it just literally there's first the statement, I think, back in 2013, and then there's the status conference in 2020 or so? I'm just trying to figure out, was there anything intervening where there was some type of communication that there might be the switch?
The case was stayed for 7 years. Okay. Once the IPRs were exhausted and the court said, okay, file a status report so that we can get going again, the parties conferred and developed the joint status report that I've been referring to.
The answer is there's nothing, no communication with the court between that initial time period, the 2013 and then the 2020 status report,
absolutely
changing the claims. Is that right?
Apologies for interrupting. Not absolutely no communication. The court did ask for just periodic status updates on the course of the IPR.
But no communication regarding what claims were being asserted.
Right. There was no opportunity for that. But the critical thing is, this isn't about, I'm not talking about a motion to leave to amend here. What I'm talking about is there was an actual agreement that the district court overlooked a year later after the status conference when deciding the summary judgment issue. And it was arbitrary and capricious to go back on an agreement that the court had endorsed to litigate all three claims. And an agreement that was not simply a matter of overlooking or negligence, but one that Ingenio itself says that it wanted, because it wanted judgment, it wanted to proceed on its counterclaims.
Mr. Shi, you're into your rebuttal time.
Oh, apologies. Thank you for the advice.
Thank you. Ms. Brulette, did I say your name correctly?
You said it exactly right, and I'm very impressed. That never happens.
Please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. Amanda Brulette on behalf of Thrive. So I'd like to first start preliminarily with Judge Stoll's question, and you are exactly right. They did not ask the court for leave to amend their claim selection and instead just put it in the status report and hoped it could proceed that way. As counsel said in response to Judge Cunningham's question, I apologize if I take up my mask. There were periodic updates to the court about the status of the IPR, but in none of those did Click2Call ever raise the fact that they might be changing their claim selection. Yes, there was a status report in which Thrive said that it would pursue invalidity of claims 24 and 28, but that was in order to preserve our ability to claim invalidity of those in the event that their infringement allegations were allowed to move forward. It did not represent, as Judge Stoll acknowledged, anything in the papers that said, hey, we're agreeing to let you redo your claim selection. So this argument about some kind of express agreement is just wrong on the papers. And so unless there are any additional questions on that, I'd like to move on to the points I would like to affirmatively make today. And first, it's IPR estoppel, which does not apply to Claim 27 because that claim was not part of the final written decision in the IPR, as would be required by the plain language of the statute in order for IPR to apply.
Let me ask you, I guess the appellee here submitted a letter on February 28th of this year that came in the wake of Caltech.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it concludes, finally, given the impact of the errata, referring to the errata in the Caltech opinion, appellees no longer believe a surreply brief is necessary. I would have thought that at that point, appellee would have jumped all over footnote 5 in in Caltech and said, here's why we come, why footnote 5 answers, gives us an answer to the contention of IPR estoppel.
Well, Your Honor, I think the issue there is that footnote 5 expressly said, we're not deciding IPR estoppel as it applies to cases like ours where there was institution or partial institution pre-SAS.
Oh, no, I understand. I would have thought, though, you would have said, okay, here's the answer to this case.
Well, we think the answer was already expressly addressed both in our response brief as well as by this court's errata itself. So as we noted in our response brief, the plain language of the statute says that the petitioner of an IPR in an IPR is barred with respect to a claim that appears in the final written decision for any grounds it could have raised against that claim. And the issue with Caltech was that the decision originally said any claim or ground that could have been raised, but then the errata was issued that corrected that and said a ground that could have been raised for a claim that was in the IPR and in the final written decision. And that's entirely consistent with what we've been arguing this whole time, which is that the plain language of the statute simply says that the IPR estoppel only applies to a claim that reaches final written decision.
So let's say that the PTO instituted on all the issues in the IPR. You would agree that estoppel applies in that circumstance because though you didn't rely on DiZono for Claim 27, you relied on Freeman for Claim 27, and Claim 27 was at issue. So you would say estoppel applies in that circumstance, right?
Yes, in that circumstance it would, but that's not the circumstance here because Claim 27 was not in the final written decision.
So in your view that if, let's just assume for a minute that you filed a petition and you didn't challenge Claim 27 at all.
That's right.
There was no Freeman grounds. It was only DiZono based on limited claims that did not include Claim 27. Your view is that even though Claim 27 is a dependent claim that adds like just a few extra words, that you get to challenge, have a second bite at the apple on validity with respect to Claim 27 in district court because you chose to limit the issues that were going to be before the PTO.
Yes, and I will qualify that to say that it's not truly a second bite at the apple because you still have issues of issue preclusion and collateral estoppel, which were in the alternative grounds that we raised. So, yes, I can challenge Claim 27 because it wasn't in the petition on DiZono, but it may rise or fall with the IPR and the PTAB's decision based on the independent claim, right? So even though I can still challenge it, it's IPR estoppel essentially shuts the courthouse door. So in this case, the courthouse door is open, but I may not win depending on how the IPR went. But by the alternative there is if you say, okay, if a claim is not in the IPR and now you can't challenge it at all in district court, then you're essentially saying petitioners have to either bring all claims or no claims if they ever want to argue invalidity again. And that's simply not what the statute says.
Why didn't you go back to the PTO and say, hey, SAS says that you need to institute on all grounds. You should institute on all grounds. Why didn't you take that option that was open to you?
Well, frankly, because we had won at the IPR. We didn't want them to reopen and reconsider anything. And additionally, that's not required.
You could have had Claim 27 considered.
We could have, but we were still free to challenge that in the district court. So we didn't need to go back and say, hey, we need you to reinstitute and then argue it on this other ground. Because we were still open to challenging it based on, frankly, any ground at the district court level. Any other questions on IPR estoppel at the moment before I move on? Thank you. So the next issue I'd like to address is issue preclusion, which prevents Click-to-Call from relitigating the validity of the elements of independent claim 1, which was invalidated during the IPR. What Click-to-Call is trying to do is to relitigate that unpatentability determination because of...
Can I ask you just one more question?
Of course.
I apologize. You're not relying on Shaw at all, right?
No, we are not.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
So as far as issue preclusion with respect to the elements of Claim 1, this court has already rejected the argument in XY LLC, which is offered by Click-to-Call, that says the differing standards of burden of proof and that sort of thing between the PTAB and the district court does not provide an exception to issue preclusion. Indeed, the court below considered those arguments and expressly rejected them based on the case law, including precedent from this court. Particularly, it found that the exact same issue was present in both cases. That was the validity of Claim 1, that it had been fully litigated both at the IPR stage, and then, as Your Honors likely know, that was argued to the Federal Circuit on multiple occasions and even to the Supreme Court, which eventually affirmed the invalidity of Claim 1. And then the only issue decided in the IPR was the patentability of Claim 1, so it was necessary to support the judgment. And so the only element of issue preclusion that's left is whether there are special exceptions, and this court, or the lower court, expressly found that there had not, based on precedent from this court. And moreover, Click-to-Call has not.
Is the precedent you're relying on here, that's involving the application of collateral estoppel in a district court case based on something that occurred in a district court case. Is that correct? Or do you have any collateral estoppel cases you're relying on that are based on some the first proceeding being in the PTO?
I believe in XYLLC, it was a judgment from the PTAB on invalidity. Okay. That was found to control. So despite the fact that there is this case law stating that these different claim constructions and burdens of proof doesn't negate the issue preclusive effect of an IPR, Click-to-Call does go on to argue that try to argue the different claim constructions, but they don't really prove anything there. All they do is say these are different. You never could have proven in the district court that Dozzano is met. And that, therefore, there should not be issue preclusion.
They do seem significantly different, don't they?
They may be different in wording, but they never actually address whether the outcome of those two wordings are actually saying something different. And we'd also reiterate that at the IPR stage, the claim constructions that were offered by Thrive were the claim constructions that were being offered by Click-to-Call in the district court.
But that's not the claim construction that the board adopted.
That's right. But we will note that the claim constructions that were adopted, the PTAB did expressly find that they were consistent with the plain and ordinary meaning, which would be the Phillips construction. And yes, the district court did reach a different construction, but you know, again, both courts believe that was the plain and ordinary meaning in light of the patent.
And one more question on this other issue, the 2428 claims.
That's right.
So what about the statement where I think you all made it about their three remaining claims? Can you just speak to that a little bit? Because it seemed to imply that there was some sort of meeting of the minds, but I just wanted to hear your take on that.
Of course. Right. So as Mr. Xu mentioned, in the joint status report, plaintiff's position said, we're proceeding on alleging infringement of claims 24, 27, and 28, because those were part of the original complaint and they were not decided in the IPR. Now, as the briefing mentioned, we had a counterclaim as to invalidity in addition to defense of invalidity. And so in order to preserve our right to proceed on those three with respect to invalidity, we had to include that in the status report as well. And frankly, regardless of any agreement between the parties, which we don't stipulate that there was one, the district court still has the authority and the discretion to manage their docket how they see fit. And so they had the ability to look back and say, hey, wait a minute, you already said you're not going to trial on these. I don't want to look at them. That was within their discretion. And there's been no evidence of that being an abuse of discretion. And the final issue I'd like to address, if there are no further questions on that, is the alternative grounds for affirmance. I'd note that in a footnote to their brief, counsel noted that there was no cross appeal, but a cross appeal isn't necessary here because it would not enlarge the scope of what, I apologize, I'm losing my place. It would not enlarge the scope of their grounds for relief. So there no cross appeal is necessary, and that's the Biofora case, which I can provide a site for you in a minute. I seem to have lost it. But on the actual grounds for the alternative grounds, as was in the cited cases, Sovereign Software and Ohio Willow, if there's no addition of patentable weight, the court is allowed to find invalidity based on collateral, the grounds of collateral estoppel. So the difference between Claim 1 and 27 don't materially alter the question of invalidity or patentability because the concept of advertisement doesn't materially alter that inquiry. And that's true for a few reasons. In particular, appellants admit that advertisement was known in the prior art because that's all they can point to as showing advertisement in the 836 patent itself, is that in the prior art systems, these call bridging was done with advertisements. And so for them to now argue that advertisement somehow lends a patentable weight to their invention simply is not true.
Further questions?
Any other questions on that?
Further questions?
Okay, well, with that, I'll sit down. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Mr. Shi, you have about 2 minutes and 40 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. On the collateral estoppel question, the defense...
Can you address specifically the language of the statute that says a claim and the claim that is being relied on by Ingenio?
Of the IPR estoppel statute?
Yes.
Yeah. That language has been interpreted, so we know from SAS and from the Caltech decision confirming this, that the scope of the IPR is determined by the petition, not by the institution decision. So a claim is referring to the IPR, and the IPR is the petition. The only place one can raise a ground is in the petition. So the idea that when the final written decision somehow limits the scope of estoppel is completely false, as this court held in Caltech.
So your view is because they raised it in the petition, it is a claim.
Because they raised Claim 27 in the petition, it is a claim that was in the IPR, and so estoppel should attach to any ground that could have been raised, namely DeZono. So unless there are further questions, that I'll touch on the collateral estoppel issue. The defendant has the burden to show the lack of a fact issue on summary judgment on collateral estoppel, a lack of a fact issue on identicality. They failed that. Click-to-Call pointed out key differences in the claim constructions of voice systems and other terms, but focusing on voice system, that made the difference. And not only that, we did not merely point it out and explain why it mattered. We even cited evidence in DeZono that that the distinction was not present there and therefore mattered as to the inquiry, which was, of course, anticipation, solely anticipation. We didn't even have that burden. They have the burden to show identicality, the lack of any material difference. We pointed out a material difference. They never bothered to explain why that wasn't material. And they never attempted to rebut the evidence that Click-to-Call pointed out. So I was disturbed to hear the continued mischaracterization of our arguments as solely being, well, the claim constructions are different, therefore that's it. We didn't just say the claim constructions are different. We pointed out the differences, explained why they mattered, and even showed, which was never required, showed that they would actually be outcome determinative. So in that matter, there's no identicality. I can point to the district court briefs at 1709 to 11, where this was raised. And they cite the DeZono, they cite evidence in DeZono, including, and I'll give you the pin site since the district court brief didn't have the appendix. It was the appendix page 1710. I see I'm over, but I'm happy to answer any more questions.
Any questions?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Shi.
Thank you.
The case is submitted.